You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. The poet Joseph Brodsky wrote, geography blended with time equals destiny. It's a great equation. And for author Judith Freeman, that meant growing up in Ogden, Utah, in a devout Mormon family, the sixth child of eight, the second girl, during the 1950s, a member, as she says, of a tribe bound by clan, blood, and ritual. A tribe, she writes, quote, deeply embedded in the landscape of the American West. The possibility of nuclear war was always a presence. Judith Freeman spent the first night of her honeymoon, her first marriage, age 21, in a small town in the desert on the border between Utah and Nevada, a town with a small Air Force base from which the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, departed for its mission and to where, she tells us, it returned. Geography blended with time equals destiny. So how do we find our destiny? Which disadvantages, which advantages, which mentor or even nemesis met at just the right time compels decisions that inform our course in life? It's a question that has informed the great memoirs since the Confessions of St. Augustine. The Latter Days is a story of an author's young life. It is also the story of a life told by a master storyteller. Ursula K. Le Guin commented on how The Latter Days is written, she said, with thoughtful, hard-won honesty. Hard-won indeed. What does it mean to grow up in a closed society governed by a male religious hierarchy? We live in patriarchy with a particular intimacy in Mormonism, Freeman has commented. A Catholic priest does not live in your house with you and act as your father. But a Mormon bishop might be your father, a Mormon priest is your brother, an elder is your uncle. What are the costs of obedience and the costs of seeking freedom? And what memories do we hide from ourselves? What do we risk by seeking to bring them to the light of day? Following Judith Freeman's quicksilver mind as she wrestles with these questions is one of the many pleasures of this astute, timely, and beautiful memoir. She says, a woman willing to be generous with her past is a woman who can be generous with herself. And this is a generous book. Judith Freeman is the author of four novels, Red Water, The Chinchilla Farm, Set for Life, and A Desert of Pure Feeling, Family Attractions, A Collection of Stories, and The Long Embrace, a biography of Raymond Chandler. She's taught writing at USC and around the country, and her essays and articles have appeared in many periodicals, including the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, and many others. Michelle Hunnevin is the author of four novels, including Round Rock and Jamesland, Blame, and Off Course, a New York Times editor's choice. She currently teaches creative writing at UCLA, and we are delighted to welcome her back to the stage of Aloud, where Judith has also been a guest as well. Please join me in welcoming these two great authors back to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michelle, and that's Judith. And I want to thank Louise for this honor of interviewing one of my favorite authors. I've known Judith for about 20 years now, I think. But I knew of her for some years before that because when I was a struggling wannabe writer, a friend of mine suggested that I read The Chinchilla Farm because he said it was what I was trying to do. Well, I loved the book, and it was exactly what I was trying to do, to write about Los Angeles, about being new there and forming a community, a new family from a disparate crew of people. You know, I was emotional, it was lucid, and with a wonderful intelligence. The Chinchilla Farm really set the bar for me, and her influence is abundantly clear in my first novel. So I, I had this fangirl's awe of Judith. And this next incident confirmed for me a kind of cosmic connection. I joined a writing group in the mid-90s, and one of the men in the writing group was this delightful fellow named Steve Blakely, and he was very good friends with Judith. And he invited me to a dinner party where she and her husband, the fabulous photographer Tony Freeman, Hernandez, were going to be. And I had to park a few blocks away from Steve's house, and when I was walking up the hill to his house, I saw this man with an animal on his shoulder. And I came up to him, and it was this yellowy, ferret-like creature. And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "It's a chinchilla." So this seemed to me the most remarkable coincidence, that on my way, obviously, to meet the author of The Chinchilla Farm, there I see my very first chinchilla. As it happened, Tony and Judith didn't show up that night. And I understood then that the universe, to compensate, had rustled up a chinchilla as a sign to keep the faith. And the faith has been rewarded, because not too many months later, I was at a dinner party with Judith and Tony. And over the years, we've become good friends. You couldn't ask for a more appreciative or supportive colleague. I've read with enormous pleasure each of her books. And every time I wonder anew at those limpid, beautiful sentences and the extraordinary way that her emotional intelligence weaves into each one of them. I want to tell you another small story, almost as pointless as the last one. But we had lunch about 4 years ago at Little Dom's, both of us in our Paris quilted jackets. We were talking about what we were going to write next. This was during the election season, and Judith had just published an essay called, in the LA Review of Books, called The Mormon Chronicles, A Meditation in Four Parts. Starting with the assertion that Mitt Romney owed her money, his great-grandfather had borrowed $1,000 from her great-grandfather for bail. They'd both been arrested for polygamy. Miles Romney, is that his?
Yes.
Miles Romney then skipped town. Her essay was a reflection on her ongoing relationship to Mormonism as her childhood religion and also as her great subject matter. Her editor at the LA Review of Books, our mutual friend Lori Weiner, encouraged Judith to expand the essay into a memoir about growing up as a Mormon. And when Judith floated this idea by her editor at Pantheon, Dan Frank, he said this was the book he'd been waiting for her to write. So she was seriously thinking then of doing it. And here is the book, a real beauty to match the others. To me, it still seems like a miracle, a sleight of hand, that an idea floated over lunch, an idea made of breath and spoken words, can acquire materiality. Of course, it involves a lot of work and a lot of time and some huge doses of agony. But here's something which 4 years ago was a thought.
Right.
Maybe because I'm a writer, or maybe it's why I'm a writer, that I still find it magical and even miraculous that something so tangible can manifest from air. And that it does is a gift to all of us.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're here.
We do go back a long way.
Yes.
And the admiration is mutual. James Land is one of my favorite novels.
Oh, thank you, Judith. So let's talk about the latter days.
Okay.
I thought we would start talking about your father, such a complex, interesting man. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could begin by reading that short passage on page 17.
Sure. He was a complex man. He was a working class man. He had never gone to college, and nor did my mother. But he was a very intelligent guy. And he had the distinction of being really one of the few Democrats, if not the only Democrat, in our entire ward, which is what a Mormon congregation is called. He was a liberal in a state where Mormons make up the majority and usually vote as a kind of a bloc, or certainly did in those days, for Republicans. So he was a Democrat. He was somebody in the 70s who advocated for the ERA. And yet he ended up working for entities that he really despised, the military-industrial complex. So I'll just read a couple of paragraphs here. I was born into a large Mormon family that was already big when I arrived. I was the sixth child and the second girl. Two more boys would be born after me, the last when my mother was 43, making the final count, two girls, six boys. I don't think my mother's last child was planned. She hadn't intended to get pregnant again in her 40s, but then I don't think any of my mother's pregnancies were necessarily planned, though they occurred with a kind of clockwork regularity every 2 years or so. They simply happened, I think, because little was done to prevent them. My mother loved babies. She once confessed to me that during her childbearing years, every time she'd see a newborn baby, she'd think, "Oh, I must have another," even though she might have an infant only 9 months old at home. Such was her hunger for babies. My father, on the other hand, once said to me he felt he never should have had 8 children. "I didn't have the temperament for such a large family," he said, then added somewhat ruefully, "If I hadn't had 8 kids, I might have become a real musician." He told me this when I was old enough to appreciate such a comment and also be stung by it. What child wants to think she kept a father from his dreams? I should say that my father grew up in a family of 20 children. My great-grandfather, William Jordan Flake, had 2 wives and an extraordinary number of children. And my grandfather, my grandmother, was one of those children. His first wife had 11 children. His second wife, my grandmother, had 10 children. And they grew up in a town called Snowflake in northern Arizona, which was settled by my great-grandfather, Flake, and another man named Snow, Erastus Snow. And they really settled the first town in northern Arizona in the 1880s. And Brigham Young had sent colonists down to create communities because at that point they really felt like the kingdom was going to expand. And they really thought of it as the kingdom of Deseret. They thought of it as a theocracy. And it was when, of course, there were still territories. So just to sort of finish the story with Romney, yes, they were both jailed for polygamy. Yes, my great-grandfather raised $2,000 bail, $1,000 for each of them. Yes, they were able to get out and await trial, but Mitt Romney's great-grandfather never went to trial. He went to Mexico with his eventually 5 wives and created a Mormon colony in Chihuahua. My great-grandfather went to the territorial prison in Yuma and spent 6 months, a sentence, came out, went back to his 2 wives and his many children in Snowflake, and later became one of the first state senators, lived out a very long life. Maybe we could show another more dignified picture of him, number 7. He was really a remarkable colonizer, a remarkable figure in early Mormon history. And If we could show slide number 8, it shows a picture of my father and his brothers, 5 kids on
Which
there.
Which one is your dad?
My dad is the smallest one in front.
Oh.
So every summer we would go down to Snowflake, Arizona to visit my grandmother in this town that my great-grandfather had settled. And at that time there would be a Flake family reunion. Hundreds of Flakes. Snowflake was overrun with Flakes. But it was growing up with this kind of history and this sense of belonging, not only to a certain family and a tribe and a religion and a culture, but belonging to a landscape. And maybe just one more slide, slide number 9. It imprinted on me this terrific sense of the American West. Those trips from Ogden, Utah, which would take 2 days in a car with 8 kids, and driving down Highway 89 past the Big Rock Candy Mountain, through Zion and Bryce National Parks, across the Kaibab Plateau, past Colorado City, a polygamous colonist, a colony, and past the Grand Canyon. So this is some of my family, my mother, my brothers, my sister, and me standing in front. When I look at this picture, I almost think I could have been a boy. Mm-hmm. And I was a real tomboy when I was young. So those drives through the American West, the American desert, the Navajo Reservation, our extraordinary national parks, they gave me such a feeling that I belong to the West.
So when I first read The Latter Days, it came to me as an e-galley. And I read it on my mini iPad under the covers at night so to not keep my husband awake from the light. And it's that kind of secret reading so familiar from childhood. And it was peculiarly appropriate to this book because I felt at times as if your memories of childhood were just being mainlined directly into my own unconscious. The book is so immersive, and its story, while so different from my own life, is so familiar in the feel of what it's like to be in the cocoon of a family, the safety of it, but also the claustrophobia of it. You talk about how there was a sameness, a leveling out, because there were so many kids, you were just one in an organism, a piece in an organism. But then came these glimmers and beckonings of a larger world. Can you talk about what some of those were to you or how it felt for you to be in a family and how you began to notice that maybe you didn't quite fit in as snugly?
Mm. You know, I think my early years were so idyllic, as maybe many of yours were. Childhood can be a kind of a magic state, a suspended state of wonder and innocence, and we had so much fun. You know, we were really, our parents didn't have the opportunity to make us neurotic. You know, we were really treated as a group, and we were a tribe, and we were kind of always inventing games, and it seemed to me a kind of wonderful time. And I think the moment at which something else intruded was when I was 8 years old. And maybe we could put up the picture of my family, slide number 1. My oldest brother, Bob, who is seen on the top left in this photograph, was an extremely handsome boy and lovely. But he had a hard time with my father. My father could be very dictatorial and authoritarian. And my brother dropped out of high school and joined the Navy when he was 17, 18. And by the time he was 19, he had married a woman from Colombia, a quite dark-skinned, Spanish-speaking, beautician that he met in San Francisco and fell in love with. And she was older. She was maybe 26, and he was maybe 18 at the time. And she became pregnant. And this was a big drama in my family. I will never think of my parents as being racist, but they were a product of their time. And we were growing up in a completely white kind of homogeneous community. It was difficult for them to accept. And they, they did their best to sort of go along with it. But unfortunately, by that point, my brother had been diagnosed with cancer, bone cancer. And one of the things I always wondered was, he was in the Navy in 1952. He was on ships in the South Pacific. Could he have been exposed to atomic tests? How does a very healthy, you know, 18-year-old Mormon boy get bone cancer? So I wrote away for his naval records and to write this book, examined them, and I realized, no, that's not how he got it. He had some sort of lump before he even went into the Navy. But anyway, he married Alicia. They had a daughter. But this is the thing. My mother was pregnant with her last child at the same time. So in this photograph, there are seven of us, but one more will be born. Very soon, Bob will leave this group and go off to the Navy, and my mother will be pregnant. And within a space of a few months, when I was 8 years old, my mother gave birth to a son, and she lost a son, and she became a grandmother, all in this very short space of time. And this was a moment when I think all of us in our childhood have some moment that we remember as particularly profound, and this was mine. And it also sort of brought out this undercurrent, this sort of subterranean feeling in the family that we did not know how to deal with the other. Anyway, so that was one moment when things changed. But when things really changed for me was when I entered puberty. And I think that that's when many girls began to feel a kind of body shame, or shaming for sexual feelings, or a shaming for being pretty and attracting boys. And in a singularly sort of focused religion, it becomes perhaps even more difficult. So we also, at that moment, moved from a very simple house in an ordinary neighborhood into a brand new subdivision in Ogden, Utah, up high on the mountain. And now we were surrounded by doctors and lawyers and professional people. And my father worked very ordinary jobs at Thiokol Chemical Corporation, Hercules Power Company, Kennecott Copper, in the purchasing department. And yet he was an extremely intelligent person, and I think it was hard for him to be surrounded by wealthier people, more successful men, men who had careers instead of just jobs. So I think my whole family at that point went through a cathartic experience. We moved up, but we didn't necessarily feel that we entirely fit in. And at the same time, I was going through puberty, and I was really beginning to question a lot. I think it's fair to say that I had the soul of a little rebel. And
also at the same time, at that time, you got your first horse.
I got my first horse, and I've always had a great passion for horses. Horses and dogs, animals of any stripe, but especially horses. They just have the biggest hearts. I've always loved the view of the world from the back of a horse. And at this moment when I got my first horse at the age of 12, it was like freedom. And suddenly I could escape my family into the foothills with my little group of friends. And that represented an extraordinary kind of freedom that I felt. It was escaping, on an animal that was so magnificent, no one else in my family was particularly interested in horses, and B, that it took me into the natural world. And I've always had a deep affinity also for nature. So that was my release. That was one way in which I began to cut loose from the constraints of this family. Unfortunately, after a couple of years, that horse, who was quite old to begin with, was given to me by a friend's father. Lovely horse, though, still spunky. But she wandered into a barn, an old rotted barn, one night. And she fell through the rotten floor, and she kicked all night trying to get out, and she broke her leg. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, when the farmer found her in the morning, he had to put her down before I'd even knew that she'd been shot. That was also a real moment of loss, you know, for me. It changed my relationship to that natural world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, one of the ways, of course, obviously, that your childhood was unique, at least to me, is the fact that your family was deeply involved in the Mormon Church. I mean, you lived it, you breathed it. It was a daily. You were daily reminded. It was built into your daily rituals, and you know, in reading your book, it's like I was. It was like watching your mind range through your past, sort of combing for the perceptions that build your adult consciousness. You know, those moments, those incidents, and also. You know, in being a child, we're eyewitnesses to so many things that we don't understand and can't process. And so going back and writing a memoir, I think, is a way that you began to understand parts of your childhood that you hadn't at the time.
No, I think that's true. And I think, you know, we think we don't have memory, but we do. And I think if each of us sat down and really asked for memories, we would resurrect more memories than we can imagine. But I think I do have a fairly good memory. And it was when I decided to write this book and I sat down and I began to ask for those memories, they came forth quite freely and quite liberally. And I would remember being a child in a room and listening to my mother talk to her friends as they were quilting or as they were making fudge. And I remember women always had a particular way of sharing stories. And they were very free with those stories, and they were very honest and frank. They were stories about a husband who secretly drank, or they were stories about a son who was smoking cigarettes. Or they were stories about a daughter who'd gotten married out of wedlock. And these were stories that children didn't get told. But you could eavesdrop and you could tap into those stories. And I've always felt that I was raised with a remarkable set of people. Mormons can often be sort of portrayed as a kind of flat, monochromatic culture. But, you know, like any culture, there are really remarkable people. And my mother was a remarkably intelligent woman, even though she never went to college either. So a lot of these stories began to come forth. But another thing that I was very aware of is just how terribly unreliable memory is and what a set of fictions we create, what a set of stories we weave around our own experience. It serves us well, and they're not fixed. They're constantly being revisited and revised. And I really, in the book, stop and question, can this be true? Mm-hmm. Did this really happen? Am I remembering this right? And I'm really ready to acknowledge that memory is the kind of fiction that it is. But what I came to believe is that the kernel that we begin to build those memories around is a feeling. And what's important is that something made us feel something very strongly when we were young. And we remember loosely the details, the moment, the circumstances. And it isn't so important, perhaps, that all the details are correct, because what's really important to us is that something impacted us deeply. We were left with some deep feeling, and it's embedded in this particular moment, in this particular story.
This is spoken like a novelist, where novels, you know, are a lie in service of the truth, or fiction is a lie in service of the truth.
Right, but, you know, we live inside a great fiction.
But not everybody is a great storyteller. You're a great raconteur, and you have stories, I think, in your blood. And one of the things that struck me about this book is how you ascribe so much of who you are to being a religion that you have since somewhat, to a large degree, rejected. And one of the things about Mormonism that comes out in your book is that it's a religion of stories and childhood. There are the childhood stories that you're told that have angels and golden tablets and secret languages, which, of course, is the Mormon story. And you were just sort of immersed in it. She had a 95-year-old great aunt who came to live with you, who was hard of hearing, and she played the Book of Mormon on the phonograph very loud on endless loop. So Judith was sort of steeped in it, and she talks about how certain parts, the bloody parts, or the she would sort of surface and pay attention.
The more exciting parts of the Book of Mormon, even though Mark Twain called it chloroform in print. And it really is kind of a tough read, but it's stories. Joseph Smith told an extraordinary story, and Fawn Brody, who wrote his biography, in that biography, No Man Knows My History, at one point said she was surprised that no one had ever looked at the Book of Mormon as an example of early frontier literature. Because it's an extraordinary record of the Americas, a story about people coming from Palestine in small boats in 600 BC and landing in what's now sort of Guatemala. And then it's a good brother, bad brother story, the Nephites and the Lamanites, and the bad brother is cursed with a dark skin, and they become the American Indians. And then these people fight each other until 300 or 400 AD, when the last of the Nephites, the white people, are slaughtered, and the last record keeper, Mormon, buries the golden plates in upstate New York, and there they are for Joseph Smith to find in 1821 or whatever it was. An extraordinary story. And for children, you know, it had all those elements of magic. A talking angel who comes to Joseph Smith and tells him, I'm going to show you where to find these golden plates, but not yet, you're too young, but I'll come back in a while, another year, and then you can dig them up. And there's this box of golden plates, and in them are, you know, magic glasses and a magic breastplate and magic tools to help Joseph Smith translate these golden plates into the Book of Mormon. And as Harold Bloom is, you know, kind of in awe of Mormonism as a extraordinary American story, mm-hmm. an extraordinary American religion, and Joseph Smith as a great charismatic figure, this religion could have not arisen anywhere else but America. But part of the story is that when it's a story of persecution and exile, and it's part of what has made Mormons seem a little bit peculiar. They were a tremendously persecuted sect in the 19th century, and thus the great exodus to the West, looking for a refuge, looking for the new Zion. And when they set off to make that journey, the reason it's called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter Days, it was a millennial sect, and they believed we did live in the latter days, that this is the end time and it's near. And so every one of those pioneers was encouraged to keep a journal. and to record their experiences. And so my great-great-grandfather, who knew Joseph Smith, who joined the church at that point in its history, and everyone from then on kept journals and kept records of their experience. And to this day, that's a very important thing to Mormons, is that you keep diaries for your children so that they will understand their history. They will understand where they came from. That's storytelling. And I was so surprised when I began working on this book. I knew my mother had written a memoir at the end of her life. I had a copy of it. I knew my father had written the Reminiscences of Leroy C. Freeman. I had a copy of that. But when it came down to the book being copy edited, I had said about something from my mother's self-published autobiography. And my copy editor said, there's a correction I need to make because I checked your mother's autobiography online. And I thought, how extraordinary that my brother, the genealogist in the family, has seen that these records are available now online. I had no idea that this little self-published autobiography had ended up online. So in that sense, I guess that I did come from a storytelling people.
And there's something else too, which is, I mean, you have your mother and her quilting friends kind of telling secrets and telling those stories. You have these mythological stories from Mormonism. And then there's another strain that starts to work into your life about as an adolescent and older, you began to see, I would call them secrets of your own. You began to have interactions with men, elders in the church that were not very copacetic, one might say, that were fairly inappropriate. You began to see a secret side of religion as well. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to me, this is all a prescription for the making of a novelist, that there are these secrets that start to put pressure on you that need out, that need to come out. And so you begin at a certain point later in your life, or you decide at a certain point that you want to be a writer. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if it isn't kind of the pressure cooker of a storytelling tradition plus the need to express things that were inexpressible.
Well, one thing that is a part of the tradition is that Mormons believe very strongly in telling faith-promoting stories. When I grew up, that was the phrase, that we should all tell faith-promoting stories. And there's much about that that's good. And there certainly is, in the history of that people, a remarkable achievement. The Exodus, the coming to the West, the creating of a strong society, most of those religions that came out of what was called the burned-over area in the early 1800s disappeared. The Oneida Society, other religions that were sort of visionary, but the Mormons survived. And in part, they survived because they arrived in Salt Lake City. It was going to be their refuge, their Zion, their escape. Unfortunately, gold was discovered in the West a year later, and it became the highway for getting to California. And they made an enormous amount of money, people coming through Salt Lake City and resupplying. But there was always this idea that we need to tell faith-promoting stories. And so a lot of the history was effaced, the parts of the history that we didn't want to acknowledge, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, a terrible part of Mormon history that needed to be reckoned with but was not reckoned with, where 120 people, an entire wagon train, was slaughtered by a group of Mormon men in concert with some Paiute Indians who they'd gotten to work with them. 70 women and children were killed for really no reason. We didn't tell that story. We told other stories. But listening to those women talk about their private woes being a silent witness to that made me very aware that that we're all so complex, and that it's better that we tell fulsome stories, that we tell stories about our faults as well as our strengths. And I don't exactly know where the church is with that at the moment, but I started this book, as Michelle said, when Lori Weiner asked me to write a piece for the LA Review of Books. And it was during Mitt Romney's run for the presidency, which now looks rather great. But I was interested in the fact that Romney wasn't speaking about his religion at all. He made that choice. Right or wrong, it was his choice. But there are parts of Mormonism, certainly there are temple rituals and things that they want to hold secret. But there's a lot that they just simply don't put out into the world. So there's always been this kind of idea that they're a peculiar people, is the term that gets used, because a lot is held in confidence, a lot of belief and a lot of what goes on in the church is for the people in the church, not the people outside. But I thought it was very interesting when Romney was kind of toying about running this time, his wife said, this time he's going to talk about his religion, and this time our headquarters for the campaign are going to be in Salt Lake City. I mean, we all know it's a rather toxic landscape out there, so people, politicians, make the choice they do. But I always thought that would have been a wiser choice, to talk with pride and with strength about who he was and where he came from.
Now, changing the subject a little bit, one of the things that got you out into the larger world was a very young marriage. You married at a pretty young age. You said you never saw yourself as a... Time to wake up.
I'm afraid this is beyond me. Oh, there you go. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. And
that's because I got married at 17. That was the reminder that wasn't a great idea.
And one of the questions that you cycle back to over and over in the church is why you married whom you did, which was your sister's ex-boyfriend, who was 7 years older than you were?
6 years old.
6 years older. Mm-hmm. In a novel, there would be all sorts of motivations for such an act, competition with your sister, trying to be your sister, punishing your sister. In a novel, there would be all sorts of reasons. How do you think about it now?
Well, I think about it as a very recently excavated territory. Uh-huh. For so many years, I didn't think about it, and in fact, it sounds ridiculous, but most of my life, I've never thought of myself as a teenage bride, let alone a teenage mother. I was married at 17, and I was a mother by the time I was 18. Somehow I never associated that. And I certainly never spent much time thinking about the fact that I married my sister's ex-boyfriend, or even questioning, why did I get married at 17? But part of what happened when I began writing this memoir is that I opened up that can of worms. And I really, for the first time, as with many other parts of my past, said, let's look at this. Mm-hmm. What was going on there? John Thorne, who I married, was a really lovely man, a father of my son. But he was in love with my sister. He was so in love with my sister, and they were pinned, and they were going to get married. But he went off to the Naval Academy. My sister was 4 years older. So he was 2 years older than she was. But while he was gone, she met a returned missionary and broke his heart. I remember him coming back to the house and almost pleading with her, but it was too late. She was engaged to marry this returned missionary. Fast forward a few years, and I'm at a church dance, and there is John Thorne, and he asked me to dance. And, you know, now I'm like 16 years old, and he's 22. And from then on, it was a very fast courtship. And he proposed to me, and I got married the day after I graduated from high school. And I think all of the things that you were proposing, a kind of jealousy of my sister, the good daughter, the good religious daughter, as opposed to the wild child, appropriating some of her power, trying to get back at her for always being held up as the model. But I really believe that I saw that as my only avenue for escape. Mm-hmm. My parents weren't going to send me to college. My best friend had gotten pregnant in high school. My other best friend had gotten pregnant before that friend. None of the girls I knew were going to college. Most of the boys were going on missions. The children in my family, when they turned 18 or graduated from high school, were expected to go to work or get married. And John Thorne and I wanted to join the Peace Corps. That was our dream. That's what we would
do. That would get you far from Ogden, Utah.
That would get me very far from Ogden, Utah. But instead, I got pregnant, and everything changed. And then, just to sort of wrap it up, at the age of 19, remarkably, I found myself on a college campus in the Midwest. John Thorne had gotten a job as a psychologist. He was getting his master's degree. He went on to get his doctorate degree. And we became dorm parents at McAllister College, this remarkably great college. And I landed on that campus. And I became a dorm mother at the age of 19 with no education, where half the kids were older than I was. But it enabled me to take classes on that campus. And for the first time in my life, I became a reader. I took a literature class, and I started reading Thomas Hardy and Henry James and Virginia Woolf. And I thought, my God, who knew? And this is what I want to do. It was kind of an instantaneous conversion of saying, wow, I think I want to do this. I think I want to be a storyteller. It would take 19 years. I never did. I left that college after a year or two. I got divorced. By the time I was 21, I was back in Ogden, Utah, living with my parents, with a four-year-old son. But I had discovered what I wanted to do. I had gotten enough, what I needed to get from that college experience to sort of set me on the path. And a mere 19 years later, I published my first book of short stories.
So here's a writing question. You have said elsewhere that writing a memoir was at times far more painful than writing fiction. That's saying a lot.
I know.
And I think in this conversation I've begun to understand why, because it is such an excavation of old tender spots. But can you talk about the differences? And
you know, writing a novel is such a great commitment and puzzle. And extraordinary challenge. You've really got to have the stuff to stay the course and to each day get up and try to bring together that idea in some cohesive way. Writing a memoir requires the same kind of stuff, but you are excavating layers of the past that are sometimes so painful. Mm-hmm. Just so ridden and laden with pain, relating to family, relating to choices, relating to loss, that it just adds that extra layer of feeling. You can't escape that. You know, there were times when I was writing this memoir when I would sit and just weep. Mm-hmm. And then you would weep through that passage and you would go on. And there would be both this cathartic feeling that you've released it and that it's just more information that you were going to have to continue to excavate. But the other thing was interesting is that I've used so many of my memories, as we all do, in fiction. We mine our lives for incident. Mm-hmm. And I found that once you use a memory in fiction, it no longer belongs to you in the same way. It becomes something else. It loses its, not exactly purity, but it becomes compromised in some way. It becomes sort of a memory, but also a little fictiony. Mm-hmm. And what I had to do is those memories that I had used in the chinchilla farm, I had to go back and extract and pull out of that novel and bring back and look at in an entirely new way and try and come closer to getting back to the original feeling of that moment. And that was difficult, too.
Well, now, you've written, you know, autobiographically in fiction before, and then in your novel, Red Water, you did years of research, starting with the
Mountain Meadows Massacre. Right.
And you said that you read for 2 years before you wrote anything. Researched. So that gave you a different layer of expertise about your great subject matter of Mormonism. How did that inform you? Looking back at your own past, how did that vast body of research that you'd done, how did that affect the way that you looked at your own life?
Well, I think for one thing I have to say, it gave me, reading 19th century Mormon Utah Western history, gave me a tremendous respect and admiration for the pioneers. It also... In account after account, I ran across the names of my own ancestors. They are part of that record. And I would be reading along some account, and there would be my great-grandfather on one side, and there would be someone else who was Brigham Young's, you know, right-hand man and Indian interpreter. Another relative was the first to attempt to write a dictionary of the Paiute language. That gives me pride, that gives me pleasure to connect with that history. I also saw the dark side of the history, and there's a very bloody, violent aspect to 19th century Mormon history. And so it one has to confront that as well, mm-hmm. and that's not faith-promoting stories. They're stories that balance the picture and make it seem more human. Yeah.
Okay, well, I have about 30 other questions, but it's time for us to open it up to the audience. They will bring you a microphone.
Let's start with a question here. Just because this is a wonderful conversation, just because you haven't gotten to talking about your son yet, could you talk a little bit about how his particular heart problem, you know, influence, again, put you on another kind of path and affected your choices?
Very briefly, when I had my son Todd when I was 18, he was born with a transposition of the great arteries, which is a really, really serious congenital heart, for which they had only recently developed a kind of palliative surgery to try and keep those children alive long enough so they could weigh 30 pounds, so they could be put on a bypass machine to have this very experimental surgery. The aorta and the pulmonary are switched. The inside of the heart can be reconfigured. But it was a really recently invented surgery. And to be that young and to have had the dreams that I had that I was going to go into the Peace Corps and instead find myself looking at a very long period of trying to get that child healthy enough to be able to go on a bypass machine to weigh 30 pounds. And he spent most of the first 6 months of his life in a little incubator, Isolette. And I would go every day to the hospital and sit there with him. But it was a very, very strange experience, to be a mother and yet to never be able to hold that child, and to be that child and never be able to be held. But finally, when he was 6 months old, he could come home. But then I had the responsibility of caring for a very fragile child and for a couple of years. And my grandmother, who also kept a diary, came to visit during this time when my son was about a year old. And in her diary, I later found out she had recorded, Judy came with her husband to visit, and she brought her afflicted babe. And that term, her afflicted babe, he was very small, he was very blue, and, it was a tremendous challenge, but he made it. We were able to take him to Minnesota for surgery at the University of Minnesota, the Variety Heart Hospital, and against all odds, he made it. And that move, taking him to Minnesota, John getting the job on the campus of McAllister College, me discovering literature, me knowing at that moment I wanted to be a writer. This is how things happen. This is how chance and luck and fortune works. It delivers you a bit of bad fortune, and then that bad fortune takes you to a place you never would have gone otherwise, in which you discover something so important. And today he's 50 years old. He's a school teacher, and he's one of the few adults who had that very early primitive surgery, who has not had to have further medical intervention. He's an outlier, and he's doing terrific. So,
hi, as you spoke about excavating these memories and trying to figure out more of what was the real kernel of feeling and maybe some details of the events, did that include... You talked about reading journals and diaries. Did you also speak to your siblings and other relatives, or was it all your own personal lonely excavation?
That would have been a very good thing, and that's exactly what Mary McCarthy did in her 1957 memoir, Memories of a Catholic Girlhood. She would go back after writing a chapter and talk to her brother or talk to another relative and say, did I remember this right? And very often they would say, no, that's not what happened. Unfortunately, I'm not close to my sister and my brothers for various reasons, part of which is explained at the end of the book. But I felt that I had to do this one on my own. So I didn't consult. It's me and my memory.
I was curious, as a writer of fiction, did you always feel like you had a memoir in you, or do you feel like the fiction was a way of writing towards the memoir, the use of family stories and your own story in your fiction? And also, could you talk briefly about the photo on the cover?
That's my friend David Francis, also a wonderful writer. And... I never wanted to write a memoir. My attitude was I really wanted to be a fiction writer. I wanted to be a novelist, and I wanted to write short stories. And that's what I did in the first five books. And my attitude was, why would you waste all that good material on a memoir when you can put it in fiction? You know, this was a lot of the stuff that I drew on for fiction. I never was writing toward a memoir. I never thought it was really something that I wanted to do. But it began simply because of that essay I wrote and the tone that I found, and the voice. I thought, now is the time. And I really had never really seriously considered it before. I felt like my memories were part of my great resource for writing fiction, that they were, that was my stock. and that was what I drew on to combine with imagination to create a story. But it was just time. It just felt I'd found the voice, I'd found a tone, and now I was going to do it. And the cover. This cover, which my husband, who's a photographer, his printer, I had sent him a number of photographs from the book to be scanned. And one of them was a picture of me in my high school play. And it's in the book, the photograph, the group photograph. And he emailed me and said, "Is that you with the eyes in that photograph?" And I said, "Yeah, that's me." And he blew it up. And he kind of made a mock-up of a cover. And when he sent it to me, we both thought, that could make a really interesting cover. The high school play was The Diary of Anne Frank. And I was playing Anne Frank. And I don't think there's anyone who looks a little less like Anne Frank than this girl from Ogden, Utah, in The Bouffant. But it was a play that changed my life. It was a play that introduced me to language and to another culture and to a remarkable family who survived an enormous evil. And you don't have to know that when you look at the cover, but it's a very loaded image in a way. It's a knowing girl and it's an innocent girl. And that's the girl I was at that age, 16, when that photograph was taken.
It sounded like you admired John Thorne quite a bit and that he opened up your world exponentially and that you had a child together. So you described something, you know, a journey that sounded incredibly interesting, and then you said, "And then we got divorced." What happened?
Well, that is a story told in the book, and I think it's a story that's really best discovered there, but it has its own drama, and it relates to my child, and it relates to the circumstances in which I found myself in Minnesota. But even without that story, I think we can say that getting married at 17, you really have to ask how many marriages really work out that well when you're that young and that immature and you make that choice. And it's true, you know, you can admire each other and still not want to be married anymore. But there was an added element that came between us. I'll just put it that way. And for those of you who are interested, it's
and I no think, spoilers here.
Right.
Thank you. As a former Mormon, have you now chosen a different path, different spiritual practice, religious practice?
That's an interesting question from a very interesting person who's had an influence on my life. I've been very attracted to Buddhism and yoga since 1979 when I moved to Los Angeles. But I'm also very aware that the Dalai Lama has said, "Hey, you Westerners, you Christians, you Catholics, you Mormons, you whatever you are, I don't want you to become Buddhists. I want you to stay with your own tradition and explore that tradition." And I think that this memoir has given me, it's taken me almost full circle back to a faith that I had kind of separated myself from and said, "Well, I'm a cultural, secular, humanist, feminist Mormon. that's what I am." We might add Buddhist to that. But truly, I think that that's a wise thing that the Dalai Lama said, that we should embrace our traditions, that it doesn't mean that we have to be part of the faithful, that we have to go to church every week, but we can't cut ourselves off from who we really are. And I think spiritual life is a very private matter for the most part. I think that it's a process of seeking, and I am comfortable with saying I'm a seeker.
Now, you were telling me, though, that you've been getting some responses from some young women who are identify as feminist Mormons, which almost seems oxymoronic, but...
Yes, I just did a remarkable interview with a woman named Joanna Brooks, who has a blog called Ask a Mormon, and she is a religious studies professor, and another woman named Lindsay Park, who has a blog called Feminist Mormon Housewives. Who thought? Who knew? But there are all these young, remarkable, smart women out there who are feminist and who are identifying as feminists and who also identify as Mormon and sometimes are still in the church and sometimes are on the fringe. I find this very encouraging and very interesting that they're willing to challenge a sort of rigid patriarchy and still try and work within their tradition. I say more power to them.
I just wonder when you said that...
Could you speak up just a little
sure.
bit?
Oh, sure. When you said that you didn't, you know, didn't consult with your siblings because you're not close to them, to what degree was that your choice or was that not at all your choice and it was their doing that you are not close to them?
I don't mean to imply that I'm completely alienated from my family. My parents are gone. They died in the early 90s. The brother to whom I was really the closest, the littlest boy in this picture, we were only 18 months apart. He was gay. As adults, we were very, very close, and he died of AIDS in 1994. With the death of that brother, to whom I really felt he was my soulmate, and the death of my parents, my sense of family was greatly altered. But again, there is an event that I recount at the end of the book that kind of changed the relationship, I would say, with my siblings. And it makes me think of something that Czesław Miłosz said about when a writer is born into a family, that family is finished. I'm sorry, we do our best. We try and treat everyone with a certain amount of kindness, and I certainly have no axe to grind. But it's dangerous having a writer in the family. You know, all of your stories are vulnerable. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Judith. And
thank you so much. Thank you.
Loud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Aaron Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5.